This episode highlights from the Future of Everything Festival, where Wall Street Journal editors and industry minds examine how advancements in science and tech are revolutionizing business, culture, and society. This was recorded in front of a live audience on May 9th at Spring Studios in Tribeca.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
So everyone in the food space talks about sustainability, but the word means very different things to different people. For Anya Fernald, CEO of Belcampo, it's about raising, slaughtering, and processing meat using the most humane and waste-free methods possible. Kimball Musk, on the other hand, wants to feed America's food deserts with locally sourced everything and lots of robots. Kimball Musk owns the restaurants The Kitchen and Next Door, sits on the board of Tesla, SpaceX, and Chipotle, and has an older brother you've probably never heard of. Before founding Belcampo, Anya worked alongside Alice Waters as executive director of the Slow Food Nation and is the author of several books. Please welcome them both to the stage along with Jennifer Strong, the host of our Future of Everything podcast.
It's safe to say everyone who's been on this stage this afternoon is in favor of sustainable food, but it's also safe to say that it can mean really different things to different people. So I'm going to start with you. Anya, what is sustainable food to you?
Sustainable food is the capacity to regenerate through agriculture. So our agricultural system now is fundamentally extractive. We take petroleum-based components, things like nitrogen, and we use it to add fertility to enhance the soil. That's how we farm. Sustainable regenerative agriculture looks at perennial systems, which means that plants that grow and reseed naturally and actually can sequester carbon and be a positive net player in the environment. So sustainability is simply the ability for agriculture to be a positive player and contribute to the health of the environment.
Although earlier folks would have said being vegan would be the sustainable path. That's not your belief.
I was not on that panel.
Yes.
Obviously.
Right.
I would think about it differently.
At Next Door, we believe that sustainable food is supporting your local farmer. They use many of the same methods that you described, because local farmers are going to care for their land. The dollars are going to stay in the economy. The food is going to taste way better. And that, to us, is sustainable.
Now, one of the first things each of you said to me on the phone the other day, and I'm going to use cleaner language here on stage, both of you said, food should not taste bad. And I think that's, on the one hand, a fairly low bar to set, but it says something, right, about the current state of our culture.
Yeah, I mean, let me do a show of hands. Who in the last 10 years has eaten at a Chili's or an Applebee's? Okay, that's an industrial food restaurant. The nature of that food is it's shipped in from thousands of miles away. It is literally, the chef's tools are a pair of scissors. They cut it out of a plastic bag, they heat it up in a microwave oven, and they put it on your table. And it fundamentally doesn't taste very good. It's compared to food that's grown locally, compared to food that is freshly harvested without the transportation, which can focus on it actually tasting good, it just doesn't compare. The problem is Chili's and Applebee's and those guys are a pretty low price point. And if you eat at any of the restaurants that I'm sure you guys love in New York City, they're not even close. They really are a completely different price point. But if you can figure out a way through at Next Door, working with local farmers to understand what grows really well in their neighborhood and create a menu that is delicious, that is local, you can actually get down to those same price points. So at Next Door, our goal is to have people change the way they think about those kind of foods and understand that there is an option to eat real food and break bread with your friends in a fun environment. Right now, if you want to eat real food, you've got to go to Chipotle or a few fast casual joints, and there's no social experience. That really is something that we want to keep in our society. I love breaking bread with my friends and my family, with my kids. And at Next Door, our goal is to work with local farmers to make that possible at an affordable price.
Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's kind of two pieces to the delicious question. And the first is I want Belcampo, our product, to be produced in the very best way possible, but I want people to love it for the flavor. Because I think we're fundamentally motivated by sensual pleasure and by the ability to go out and eat good things. So to make a repeat experience of going out and enjoying grass-fed meat and finished meat, you might do it once or twice because it's good for your heart, you want to save the planet, but you're going to make it an everyday habit. You know, so for us, the real opportunity was, okay, we can farm all this acreage, we can put all these animals into production, but then once we started to really win in, it sounds silly, but some of the burger wars and get the best burger award in LA Magazine, that was when I thought, like, okay, this is actually a credible concept. You know, this is actually getting get some traction because not only is it the best thing, but it can also be the most delicious thing. Mm-hmm. When I go and I, you know, you cruise through the airports and you see all those Asian chicken salads and the chicken Caesars, and it's like a terrible tasting piece of meat. And you think an animal lived and died to make a terrible dish that's mostly likely going to be thrown away. No animal should live and die to make that salad, right?
They'll cook it 1,000 miles away from that airport, and they will laser grill marks on the chicken, literally actually laser it on so that it looks like it was cooked that day or that in that airport. And it's actually frozen, cooked months, weeks, months, many, many, long time ago, and it's reheated to order. It tastes terrible, and yet that's what we're faced with in most of America.
But the issue of we have these massive confinement farms and we're making people sick and putting lagoons of waste near communities and saturating the air with antibiotics to make something that tastes pretty awful, there's just a lose-lose. So that's where I feel confident about the vision that we're talking about, that let's eat less, let's eat better quality, and it can be sustainable. There's the win.
Now, you two are trying to scale very different businesses, but something else that you have in common is this need for infrastructure. And you talked quite a bit about that the other day, including slaughterhouses. You have different thoughts there, but if you want
to maybe good to explain why the slaughterhouses are harder, and then you should just tell your story. You need the U.S. the government to actually certify a slaughterhouse. And so as the industrial food system grew up, they just started isolating them in different parts of the country. So for a while, we have our restaurants in Memphis. We'd raise the cattle locally. We'd buy the whole cow from the farmer. And then they would ship it to Colorado to be slaughtered and ship it back. It was so stupid. Now it's more available, so I think that's what you're doing is great.
Yeah, so we actually built the first USDA-certified multi-species slaughterhouse we built in California in about 50 years. We opened that in 2012.
50 years?
Yeah. Anybody who's looking for a lot of challenges, think about opening a slaughterhouse. Every day there's a different challenge, and they're never very pretty. But it's been a great learning experience. And to my, you know, I think the USDA gets sort of blamed for the slaughter bottleneck, but I actually put the blame more on the American consumer. You know, we want to eat a lot of ribeyes in New York, and that's less than 10% of a whole beef is something you could throw quickly on the grill. We don't really want to braise every day. And if we were to eat whole animals, we'd be braising every day. So a lot of the reason why there's so few slaughterhouses, it's not as much about regulatory compliance as it is about consumer demand. Since there isn't whole animal demand, the whole meat system evolved to have much more efficient funnels of product and much better allocation. Mm-hmm. So that we were able to, you know, you go into a butcher shop, you look at the length of that case there for you, you know, 90% of that is 10% of the animal. 90% of that steaks from those two nice big rib chops, right? The rest of it, all the shanks and all the claw and all the shoulder, that gets moved into other channels for commercialization. A lot of it's shipped overseas. So the slaughter industry has evolved to serve the American palate and the American taste, which wants quick, easy to cook, appealing
I'm not sure
things.
If it's just the palate, because in the restaurant world, we buy whole animal, the whole cow, and we have our higher-end restaurants that we will serve the prime cuts, and they're not that much in a cow, but the rest we do ground beef or braised food through Next Door, which is actually, at the end of the day, very affordable. I blame the restaurants and the grocery stores out there, mostly the restaurants, for not getting creative and just basically, you know, serving the ribeye. The rest of the animal's delicious. And I'm not talking about beef tongue, which actually isn't too bad, but it's really about eating the entire animal. When we work with our farmers, we have a wonderful farmer, a military veteran in Tennessee. A few years ago, I think just 2014, very recently, started 25 acres of farming, did it through a lease that he could get as a veteran, raised animals, and we buy the whole cow from him. And he's just let us know he's now going to grow to 200 acres. Before he came along, you know, there wasn't that sort of relationship where we could go buy the whole cow from him. He would have to sell just a few of the prime cuts and then just kind of sell the rest for scraps. And it's going to take restaurants in the country to understand how much tastier it is to get the whole animal that's locally produced. And it's actually not that expensive. We get a pretty good price for our whole cow program compared to the industrial food system where you have to just get little pieces back and forth and the shipping costs and the damage to the environment. If restaurants start doing what we do, I think we would have a boon of local farming. And I think the consumer would love it because it does taste great.
Yeah, and I think there's been a shift in recent years to these kind of forgotten cuts of people going to Europe and saying, well, why don't we have picanhas and bavettes and things like that in America? And the answer is the cows are still built the same.
Right.
They go into grind, right? They just get moved through different channels.
But it does bring us back to that question of infrastructure, right? Because as something, Kimball, you mentioned, the struggle of finding someone who can cook from a whole animal in these cities where you're opening these restaurants.
Well, today's age of automation is incredible, where if you want to braise some pork, for example, it can take many years for you to train a chef to learn really how to get it to that perfect falling off the bone texture, not too dry and not too tough. And it really is an apprenticeship that you go through that could take someone 5 to 10 years to really understand how it's supposed to be and how it's supposed to taste. Automated ovens today, we have some of the most advanced ovens in the world. We have chefs in home office that are 2-star Michelin chefs. We used to work in some of the best restaurants in the world, coding with a software engineer an oven that when a young 18-year-old chef who has very little training but a good person, great attitude, the cut comes in from the farmer, obviously you need the human element. Is this good quality food? Is this some basic seasoning? But then the oven takes over and can sear the outside of the pork. It can braise it down, bring it to that perfect texture and taste that actually comes through feedback from the meat itself. So automation is enabling real food at scale that simply wasn't possible before. You had to ship it in a plastic bag and give the chef a pair of scissors.
Yeah, and Kimball brings up a good point, which is one of the challenges, I think, for both our businesses is just the broad de-skilling of the workforce in both the restaurant space and in agriculture. For me, it represents less in the oven. I wish I had an equivalent of that for the farming side, where I'm talking to a guy who comes from an operation where there's some pivots, big irrigation systems that are run off of their phone, to, in my operation, we're talking about rotational grazing and management of 25,000 acres, and you have to get people out there, eyes on the ground, looking at the cover, how things are growing, being very, very intuitive and responsive. So one of the great things about the American ag system as it's built now is that it's extremely efficient and effectively doesn't require a huge amount of creativity. That's one of the big roadblocks for us, and the challenge at scale is going to be the talent and reskilling that workforce.
Mm-hmm. And going back to some of these words around sustainable food, something you two don't necessarily agree on is grass-fed versus organic.
Call it a disagreement. I think we just have a different taste palette. Like, I prefer grain-finished, organically grain-finished. I just prefer it. We actually control every single thing that animal eats. So if we wanted, we could choose to make it grass-fed. We just choose not to. But it's a great product. For us personally, we prefer a little bit more marbling in the meat.
And I want to clarify, we are organic and grass-fed and finished. We actually finish out our beef up to 28 months compared to a conventional operation is at 18. So we get a much better marble on the meat by taking another 10 months. I agree that the standard on grass-fed meat's seasonal because grass is seasonal, so it can be very variable. And also when you have guys who are playing in the commodity space, they are finishing out at 18 months, which is essentially just the animal is beginning to frame out and develop more musculature. So in our case, by owning the whole supply chain and being able to really control the end user experience and charge a premium price for it, we're able to afford to take these animals to a full maturity. Sure. On grass. It just, if you or I were to eat, think about it, only seasonal greens that you grew in your front yard or a container full of Fritos that got parked there once a year, how would you gain weight more quickly, right? So if you have animals on that intensive grain diet, they simply go through sexual maturity and they finish out and get fatter faster. You can achieve that, and actually the best tasting grass-fed animals can be 3-4 years old, but you can get that just by patience, a little bit more time.
One more thing for you, Anya. I wanted to ask you about carbon, speaking of various buzzwords in the food industry. That's something the meat industry often takes a sizable hit for, but you doing it differently, you say you are carbon positive.
Yeah, so we have 25,000 acres. Only 2,000 of that ever has any tilling. The rest of it's all perennial grasses. So in California, like in Colorado, we're blessed with just a lot of native grasslands. Mm-hmm. Those grasses, the technical part of it is the roots go 30 feet deep. So it's actually a perennial ecosystem that is able to sequester carbon. So we're working with two different carbon monitoring groups to track carbon sequestration. And we are preliminarily at 5 years carbon positive. And that simply has to do with having a low density of animals. And I do take issue with this, like beef has this footprint. And the analogous story for me is, you know, I can get from here to that wall by riding in a Hummer or riding on a bicycle. Is the carbon footprint the same between the two because I'm getting from here to that wall? No, it's completely different. So the mechanism is very, very important. With a grass-fed, grass-finished animal, 100% on perennial ecosystem, the environmental impact is entirely different from feeding them intensively farmed corn and soy.
One of the things we do, we understand the carbon impact too, and our farmers, I think, probably do a good job, maybe not at the same level as you do, but we also work hard at Nextdoor to reduce the amount of beef consumption. So we have a 50-50 burger, which is half mushroom and half beef, which is fantastic. And mushrooms have a real earthy, meaty flavor. So it's different, of course, to a straight-up burger, but it is equivalent or better in many places, and it sells as well as a cheeseburger. We have two reasons why we do that. One is carbon, to just be a better, sustainable for the planet. But also, our farmers can't grow that fast. So we actually ended up doing it mostly because our farmer just couldn't say, well, he had 5,000 acres, he's just going to add 5,000. You just can't do that. It has to be contiguous and so forth. And we didn't want to change suppliers, so we created this 50-50 burger that we did two things. We moved the burgers to the right of the menu, and then instead of right in the center, and then we added a 50-50 burger, and we halved our purchasing of beef.
That does it for time for us. This was truly my great pleasure. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green, Brian Gutierrez, Kristen Schwab, Laura Sim, and Garrett Crow. John Wurdock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Nikki Waller and Kim Last, with special thanks to festival organizers Karen Annis, Catherine Sterling, Andrea Acosta, Robin Wood Saylor, and Anna Rafdahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in New York.